The bulletin says that the sermon title this morning is Summer Salmagundi. Salmagundi is a mixed dish of chopped meat, anchovies, eggs, onions, oil, about anything else the cook thinks might help. The French would call it potpourri. The Spanish say olla podrida. And the Americans talk about a hodgepodge or a Mrs. Murphy's chowder made of whatever one can find to throw into the pot. I do a sermon mix like this once in a while because it gives me a chance to answer questions people have asked over several weeks, or it rescues some brief item I've had lying on the desk that is too short for a sermon, but may speak to somebody's interest before it gets consigned to the wastebasket. Item one. Somebody asked the other day about a certain moment in our worship. Why do we do it this way? Is it something we've always done? I think one of the most fascinating things about church life is how quickly things become traditional. And then, before you know it, sacrosanct, meaning they cannot even be touched. I remember a fine deacon in another church who was to read scripture for me one morning and who asked if it would be all right to change the prevailing custom and leave off the sentence, "Here endeth the reading of the morning scripture." He either didn't know or had forgotten that we had not been doing that at all until a man came to be a co-minister with me and brought the practice along with him. It's a perfectly good way to end a reading, but I had never used it because it was a bit more formal than I wished to be, and I would have felt a little phony picking it up just because it appealed to my colleague. So I could understand the deacon's feeling that it was not quite his style either, and did he have to do it? He was not, after all, a professional student of the Bible. For all he knew, Jesus himself might have commanded us to say, after we read the Bible in public, "Here endeth the reading of the morning scripture." He didn't want to upset the multitude who had gotten used to it by then and would have felt cheated not to hear it. I told him he could do as he pleased. He left it off, and no deacon ever read it again from that day on. We had established another tradition. Our worship in this church is rather plain and simple, but we've done the few things we do long enough to have made it a little risky to change. I would like us occasionally to sing the Lord's Prayer in unison, which I happen to think is a beautiful exercise, but I haven't had enough passion about it to insist. I suppose because I know it would cause some dear friend to say, "I don't care for this musical prayer. We've always spoken it. Let's just keep it the way it is." I have hinted several times that I'd love for us to have a brief communion service sometime after an all-church dinner, right at the table, because that would be so much more like what Jesus had in mind for us than what we do on Sunday mornings. But it isn't traditional, and so far nobody has leapt up eagerly to say, "That sounds great, I'd like to help you do that." I found out years ago that it's possible to offend good people simply by addressing God differently in prayer, in non-traditional language. I use almost exclusively the common pronoun you instead of the these and thous we've all heard when we were growing up. And a man who pays attention to such things asked me the other day why I did that. I explained quickly that lots of people do it, especially those who prefer to address God the way early Christians did, who had no special pronouns for use in prayer. A first century Jewish or Christian woman who prayed to God used the very same pronoun she used to speak to her husband or child. Jesus did not really say to God, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" using a sanctified verb form and second person pronoun reserved only for religious use. He said, simply, in his language, "My God, why did you forsake me?" So where did we pick up the these and the thous that most people think are biblical? Well, the answer is that they came from the time of Shakespeare with its double set of pronouns. When the King James Version of the Bible was translated, and because that particular version was dominant in the English-speaking world for nearly 350 years, we grew up thinking God could only be addressed by using special, holy pronouns different from the ones we use in ordinary speech. Pronouns that sound more sacred somehow, that smell like incense from the altar, that comfort us with the music of the familiar. And by now, the tradition is so strong that many people actually feel it's irreverent to speak to God in prayer in any other way. The sound of thee and thou and other King James English is right for religion, despite the fact that no woman in this room would ever dream of saying to her husband, "Wouldst thou bring a loaf of bread when thou comest from thy work tonight?" In all probability, he wouldn't come home at all. There's a funny example of how archaic language may keep its hold on us. In a little-known novel called No Time for Sergeants, the main character, whose name is Will, is asked by his father to read a little scripture out loud because the old man has just misbehaved, and he thinks hearing the Bible read would constitute a kind of cleansing. So the son reads, and the old man listens and starts to feel better. He talks a bit, and then he says, "Will, why don't you read a little more out of that Bible?" And the son starts reading again from a place with a lot of big words in it, and he says to us, "I done pretty good with it, I think. I throwed in a lot of these and thous, and verilies, and things like that. And when I hit some of the big names, I just called them Sam or Joe or whatever come into my head," but he didn't know the difference. He nodded his head up and down, looking like he felt better. "I read, and he saideth, verily, thee unto thou. And he cleared his throat and said, "That's the truth too, Will. That's the truth." It didn't matter for the old man whether the words made sense. He was interested in holy sounds, not the meaning he was meant to take from them. We lean I think in the other direction, in a congregational church, exalting sense and clarity above magic and mystery, believing that since our sacred book is composed of words, we ought to care enormously about what words mean. The clear windows in this room are not the result of an accident. They were not an attempt to economize. They deliberately symbolize our commitment to light, to use of the reason God gave us, to all the tools of biblical study that help us know how to interpret that often complex book. I can answer now another question I have been asked. What version of the Bible do you use in the pulpit, and what version would you recommend for reading at home? In the pulpit, for purposes of accuracy and clarity, I pick and choose from a number of modern translations: Moffat, Phillips, Today's English Version, the Jerusalem Bible, the New English, the New Revised Standard, the New International. But I cannot, in good conscience, use much from the Old King James Version, despite the fact that for many people it is still the Bible. The verbal music of it is often incomparable, but the translation is frequently poor, sometimes completely obscure, especially in the Old Testament, and written generally in language that is stilted, formal, and unfamiliar for modern readers. Insofar as this is true, it subverts the very purpose for which the Bible was written. It was never intended to become a quaint museum object, kept in a glass cage away from the grit and grime of the street. It was meant to be a relevant and challenging word from God for every generation that reads it. If you wrap it in old-fashioned language, those who read it may be lulled into thinking it is a book for the past and not for the present, a book for a special day instead of every day. I think you deserve an illustration of what I'm trying to say. A great many are possible, but here is one. In one of his letters to the church at Corinth, when tensions were running very high, the Apostle Paul says in the King James translation, "Ye are not straitened in us, but ye are straitened in your own bowels." Do you have any idea what that means? I have tried that out on whole classes of college students without finding a single one who knew what it meant. The problem is not in the Greek that Paul wrote. It was clear enough. The problem comes from the archaic language of 1611, which made sense of Paul's comment once upon a time, but makes complete nonsense of it in 1992. So what does it mean? Ye are not straitened, spelled without a G, S-T-R-A-I-T, ye are not straitened in us, ye are straitened in your own bowels. Well, any modern speech translation will make it clear but I think none better than the one by J.B. Phillips. Any stiffness between us must be on your side, for we assure you there is none on ours. That's what it means. Or if you want the New Testament to sound just a little more formal, even though it was not written that way, it was written in a very relaxed street Greek. Here's how the Revised Standard Version translates that same verse. There is no restriction in our affections, but only in yours. Now, how did we get from there to here? Well, bowels, the word bowels in 1611, was a word that meant the emotions. To have no tension meant the emotions were relaxed. The word straightened meant cramped. And Paul is saying literally, there's no tension on my part. If there's any tension, it has to be on yours. But you'd have to be, nowadays, a special student of archaic language to work that out. And as for the other half of the question, if you want a recommendation for a home Bible and you intend to have only one, I think the New Revised Standard Version of 1991 is the finest on the market, all things considered, and I think it will be useful for at least another 20 to 25 years. And finally, a word about the attitude of the Congregational Church toward conversion. I once heard a highly touted evangelist say that he and his brother had toured Texas. I was in Texas when I heard him, with a big tent, and had, quote, converted 47.8% of his prospects. It struck me as one of the oddest bits of religious nonsense I had ever heard in my life. What kind of judgment, exactly, tells one who is a prospect? And who knows except God when a true conversion has taken place? I knew what this man meant because I knew his church. What he meant was that he had baptized several of the visitors who came to hear him, because in his denomination that was the ultimate dividing line. Before you were wet, you were a lost soul. After you were wet all over, you were saved and bound for glory. And it struck me in my years in that denomination that we expended about 95% of our energy getting people into the water and about 5% in follow-up. Real Christian faith, by Christ's own words, grows in the heart like a blade of corn out in the field, silently and slowly. Huge rallies featuring famous names and backed up by rock stars and rich athletes generate a passing excitement, but studies indicate that their permanent impact is rather insignificant. Mature faith is a quieter thing. To speak softly when one is angered, to pay the bills when one has the money, to spare someone an embarrassment, humble and prosaic things like that bear true witness to your faith. And I think Paul Scherer put it well. The fundamental joy of being a Christian consists not in being good. I get tired of that. but in standing with God against some darkness or some void and watching the light come. The joy of religion is in having your fling at shaping, as a potter shapes a vase, one corner of his eternal kingdom. One small corner. At home, at your office, in your classroom, on the soccer field. Garrison Keillor may have done it even better. What keeps our faith cheerful, and it ought to be prevailingly cheerful, what keeps our faith cheerful is the extreme persistence of gentleness and humor. Gentleness is everywhere in daily life, a sign that faith rules through ordinary things, through cooking and small talk, through storytelling, making love, fishing, tending animals and sweet corn and flowers, through sports, music, and books, raising kids, all the places where the gravy soaks in and grace shines through. Even in a time of enormous vanity and greed, one never has to look far to see the campfires of gentle people. So, no trumpets, no brass bands, no television spectaculars or traveling tent shows, just a kind of quiet cooperation with God to leave things someday a little better than we found them. Would you settle for that as an epitaph?